Conservative? You bet. Controversial? Right again. It's time to squabble on the Jim Benson Show.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Jim Benson Show, conservative talk radio covering the issues that concern you here on the BBS Radio Network. Just after Joe Biden was inaugurated, political commentator Dick Morris, on his Lunch Alert program, broadcast on his website, dickmorris.com, did a segment called Wither Biden. On that program, Morris asked what kind of president could we expect Biden to be and offered three possibilities. One was the left-leaning centrist of years past, in which Joe Biden was willing to work with both sides of the political spectrum and tended to take a more pragmatic approach to passing legislation. Another was the sort of noncommittal Doolittle Joe Biden of his 2020 presidential campaign, who wouldn't commit to much in the way of political positions, although there were some notable exceptions that demonstrated a definite leftist trend. The third possibility, if I'm interpreting Dick Morris correctly, was a Joe Biden committed to the radical leftist and globalist ideas and positions of many of those who were supporting his candidacy. We now know that Beijing Biden, as he's been referred to, is definitely behaving strongly as that third possibility. On a past episode of this program, I played audio from a short campaign ad Biden had in which he declares that America is a, quote, idea that, quote, we never lived up to, but we never walked away from. And he goes on to slightly further disparage America before the end of the little couple-of-minute ad. Biden, along with family members, according to President Trump's lawyer Rudy Giuliani and others, has been paid tens of millions of dollars by the communist Chinese. But of course, this is no security issue, is it? He is considered by many observers to be virtually their puppet. It's clear that Biden is committed to carrying out policies which benefit communist China at the expense of America, and has been busy reversing the pro-America policies of Trump regarding China, rejoining the Paris Climate Accords, allowing communist Chinese companies to work on and provide equipment and technology for the U.S. power grid, are just a few of the many more such actions to come, I'm sure, that will serve to enrich and empower communist China and weaken and ultimately destroy the USA, or certainly potentially so. Throwing open our borders to hordes of impoverished illegal immigrants from around the world, some of whom have been previously deported for violent crimes committed here, is another example of this policy. It also serves the desires of another of Biden's masters, radical left-wing billionaire George Soros and his Open Society Foundations, a network of tax-exempt organizations which advocate for no borders anywhere in the world. Soros personally contributed $500,000 to Biden's campaign. I'm sure he probably got more from other groups associated with Soros, but anyway, Soros has called Trump a danger to the world. Rather, to Soros' plan for world domination, and with his many billions of dollars poured into left-wing organizations and causes, Soros is hell-bent to radically transform America by weakening and ultimately destroying its culture and institutions and subjecting it to the domination of a much ballyhooed new world order of totalitarian global governance. Of course, they don't explain it that way. These ideas dovetail nicely with the reported goals of globalist oligarch elites who envy the communist Chinese and long for a new world governmental order dominated by themselves as a technological elite, with everyone else subservient to them. These globalist corporate entities and individuals are now closely aligned with the communist organizations around the world and are providing huge amounts of funding. Soros, as Rudy Giuliani and others point out, is the main funder of the communist Antifa groups, along with their allies in Black Lives Matter, a thoroughly Marxist organization dedicated to the end of free market capitalism, the traditional family and private property. Just recently, Soros has given something like $250 million to Black Lives Matter alone. All this is well documented and discussed widely on the internet and elsewhere for anyone who wants to look into it. but obviously you won't find much being said about it by the so-called mainstream media and big tech organizations, which have long been an integral part of this scheme to bring about the end of America as we have known it. Just as convinced as I am of all this, so too I have no doubt, after viewing the mountains of evidence for it, that the 2020 presidential election was stolen as part of this conspiracy with rigged elections in the key swing states. Many of Trump's supporters suspect this was all part of a coup involving domestic and international players carried out to overthrow the duly elected constitutional government of the United States and install Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris to further and hasten the destruction and transformation of America as envisioned by these globalist elites and their communist and other leftist partners. Very scary stuff. I wish I wasn't having to speak about these things, but here we are. But thanks to being dumbed down and controlled as they are, many Americans are largely unaware of what's taking place before their eyes or of the implications for their own futures. Still, there are many millions of us who are more aware of information about all this. These include the close to 80 million Americans, by the estimates I've seen, who voted for Donald Trump and who don't want open borders with 20 million illegal aliens made citizens and voting for candidates of the Communist Party and its front organization, the Democratic Party, keeping them in office forever. These people don't want an end to our Constitution. They don't want their property confiscated and wealth redistributed. They don't want economic stagnation and decline. They don't want loss of their individual rights and freedoms, including religious freedoms. They don't want communism and globalism. I think it's possible to save the Republic, but we certainly have got our work cut out for us. Much of our government, including such cherished institutions as the FBI and Justice Department, the CIA, the State Department, even the Supreme Court, appear to have been seriously compromised, and if not active participants in the coup and other globalist communist endeavors, are definitely not confronting and fighting them. Now I'd like to play some audio excerpts from several online podcasts and programs in support of what I'm talking about here. To start, here's some rather prophetic comments from President Trump, I believe all made during his 2016 campaign, about how the Make America Great Again movement was, and is, an existential threat to the entrenched establishment, the so-called deep state. This is from a video on the podcast Patriot Prosperity. It's a channel available on rumble.com. Play soundbite one, please.
Our movement is about replacing a failed and corrupt political establishment with a new government controlled by you, the American people. The Washington establishment and the financial and media corporations that fund it exist for only one reason: to protect and enrich itself. The establishment has trillions of dollars at stake in this election. For those who control the levers of power in Washington and for the global special interest, they partner with these people that don't have your good in mind. Our campaign represents a true existential threat like they haven't seen before. This is not simply another four-year election. This is a crossroads in the history of our civilization that will determine whether or not we, the people, reclaim control over our government. The political establishment that is trying to stop us is the same group responsible for our disastrous trade deals, massive illegal immigration, and economic and foreign policies that have bled our country dry. The political establishment has brought about the destruction of our factories and our jobs as they flee to Mexico, China, and other countries all around the world. It's a global power structure that is responsible for the economic decisions that have robbed our working class, stripped our country of its wealth, and put that money into the pockets of a handful of large corporations and political entities. This is a struggle for the survival of our nation. And this will be our last chance to save it. This election will determine whether we're a free nation or whether we have only the illusion of democracy, but are in fact controlled by a small handful of global special interests rigging the system, and our system is rigged. This is reality. You know it, they know it, I know it, and pretty much the whole world knows it. The Clinton machine is at the center of this power structure. We've seen this firsthand in the WikiLeaks documents in which Hillary Clinton meets in secret with international banks to plot the destruction of U.S. sovereignty in order to enrich these global financial powers, her special interest friends, and her donors. Honestly, she should be locked up. The most powerful weapon deployed by the Clintons is the corporate media, the press. Let's be clear on one thing. The corporate media in our country is no longer involved in journalism. They're a political special interest, no different than any lobbyist or other financial entity with a total political agenda. And the agenda is not for you, it's for themselves. Anyone who challenges their control is deemed a sexist, a racist, a xenophobe. They will lie, 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 and then again, they will do worse than that. They will do whatever is necessary. The Clintons are criminals, remember that. This is well documented, and the establishment that protects them has engaged in a massive cover-up of widespread criminal activity at the State Department and the Clinton Foundation in order to keep the Clintons in power. They knew they would throw every lie they could at me and my family and my loved ones. They knew they would stop at nothing to try to stop me. Nevertheless, I take all of these slings and arrows gladly for you. I take them for our movement so that we can have our country back. I knew this day would arrive. It's only a question of when. And I knew the American people would rise above it and vote for the future they deserve. The only thing that can stop this corrupt machine is you. The only force strong enough to save our country is us. The only people brave enough to vote out this corrupt establishment is you, the American people. Our great civilization has come upon a moment of reckoning. I didn't need to do this, folks, believe me. I built a great company and I had a wonderful life. I could have enjoyed the fruits and benefits of years of successful business deals and businesses for myself and my family instead of going through this absolute horror show of lies, deceptions, malicious attacks. Who would have thought? I'm doing it because this country has given me so much and I feel so strongly that it's my turn to give back to the country that I love. I'm doing this for the people and for the movement, and we will take back this country for you, and we will make America great again.
Yes, Trump and MAGA and his followers were and remain a real threat to the corrupt Washington establishment and globalist elites who did everything in their power to bring down Donald Trump, eventually succeeding with a rigged election and coup, as Trump has called them numerous times. The late great radio talk show host Rush Limbaugh, who died just last week from stage 4 lung cancer, referred to Trump as the, quote, president in exile. Limbaugh had a powerful intellect and for more than 30 years provided vital information and intelligence to conservatives, helping them combat the endless barrage of the left's lies and propaganda. Limbaugh was almost always upbeat and positive in his outlook and gave us a lot of hope for a better future. He will be missed and will not be forgotten. But now it's up to others of like mind, and there are, thankfully, a lot of us, to carry on the fight. Speaking of the rigged election, Here's some audio excerpts from a very good video that came out earlier this month titled Unmasked: Have We Uncovered the Truth About the 2020 Election? You can find it on rumble.com, that's R-U-M-B-L-E.com, by searching the videos under the headings Pure Data and Election Fraud. Play soundbite 2, please.
No matter which side of the fence people have been on, they've been saying, "Show me the evidence. I'll believe it when I see the evidence." And people on both sides agree that something went terribly wrong in November 2020, but there really has been no comprehensive place to see the evidence of widespread fraud until now. This video is pure data, so don't get mad. You can't be angry when a scientist confirms that gravity pulls downward at -9.8 meters per second squared, even when that fact works against the narrative you've heard. So here we go. Just before we show you some new disturbing video evidence, we'll talk about statistical anomalies in three states in question. In the early hours of November 4th, 2020, Democratic candidate Joe Biden received several major vote spikes in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Georgia, suddenly placing him in the lead when he had been trailing Trump by a significant margin. 8,954 individual vote updates were analyzed. Across nearly all updates, there follows a clear statistical pattern. However, a very small number of batches are especially questionable. The four most notable aberrations were two in Michigan, one in Wisconsin, and one in Georgia. And all occurred in the same five-hour window, in the middle of the night, when in some places counting reportedly had stopped. Not only do these updates not follow generally observed patterns, but their behavior is particularly extreme. For context, using publicly available data from the New York Times, here is a visualization of the number of votes by candidate in Michigan from the beginning of the election night to 7 p.m. Eastern Time on November 4th. Trump is in red, Biden is in blue. Notice the sudden and improbable spike in votes for Biden at 6:30 a.m., where Biden received 141,258 votes, while Trump only received 5,968. This extreme ratio is surrounded by updates that are nearly the same in ratio. This particular update is 23 times more votes for Biden, and is the most extreme update favoring Biden in all datasets across all states. The situation in Wisconsin is even more stark. A single update to the vote count brought Biden from trailing by over 100,000 votes into the lead. Thirdly, a vote update in Georgia at 1:34 a.m. Eastern Time on November 4th, which shows 136,155 votes for Joe Biden and only 29,115 for Donald Trump. The extents of these four vote spikes in question are more than the margin of victory in all three states, which means the spikes were not only abnormal in regards to percentage for Joe Biden, but also in magnitude of the vote count. Out of roughly 9,000 updates, this election was decided by only four extreme updates, each with a probability of less than 0.1%, meaning that had these four unlikely updates not happened, we would have a different president in the White House. Detractors argue that these spikes were merely human error and not indication of fraud, and the errors have been corrected. If the errors have been corrected, where is their evidence? Why were the results never changed? Others have said that the spikes indicate heavily Democratic precincts. If that were the case, then California would show many spikes of that magnitude, but it doesn't. Only one vote update in California is anomalous in percentage of Biden votes, but not enough magnitude to shift an outcome. The strangest anomaly visible in the data is a consistently identical ratio of Biden to Trump votes across time, which is theoretically impossible. Here is Florida. These updates occurred over a week following the election. Notice all the ratios of Biden to Trump votes are 100% identical over several days. This pattern shows up in many states. It appears that a computer algorithm is involved in the process, which is doing something called weighted race distribution, a feature of Diebold voting machines known as early as 2001, which gives values to votes rather than simply counting them. Here in California, we see an update of one vote. About 65% of that value is given to Biden and 32% to Trump. How can one vote go to more than one person? It is well known and not disputed that Diebold's software was found to be switching votes through programming in past elections. Even though Diebold is no longer used, Dominion Voting Systems acquired ESNS in 2010, which had previously acquired Diebold under its new name of Premier Election Solutions. This does not exhaust all statistical data anomalies encountered in the 2020 election, but data anomalies is only one factor to consider. Next is eyewitness and video evidence. In Georgia, there's a case of a poll worker named Ruby who was seen on Instagram giving a secretive live video of her working in the back room filled with absentee ballots. At 10:30 p.m. on November 3rd, all media and poll watchers were told to leave State Farm Arena because ballot counting was going to stop. but Ruby and her daughter and three others remained behind at State Farm Arena. They pulled boxes of ballots out from under the table that was placed there in the morning and distributed them to several counting stations. Ruby is seen here in this video running the exact same stack of ballots through the machine three times. Other workers do the same. Note that a large surge in Biden votes can be observed after this tabulation at 0634 Greenwich Mean Time, which is 1:34 a.m. in Georgia, just after the time in question. You may ask, can a ballot really be counted more than once? Here is your answer from Coffee County, Georgia.
Can you scan a ballot more than once?
I've just done it.
You just keep scanning.
I just kept scanning that same. I just scanned the same batches that y'all just voted. Mm-hmm. I never got any more until that one.
I don't know why they approved such a system.
Then there is cybersecurity evidence and the question of whether Dominion voting machines were tampered with over internet connections. Signed affidavits under oath from cybersecurity experts indicate that Dominion Voter Systems and Edison Research were using an unencrypted VPN with login credentials that were easily accessible and used by foreign adversaries to monitor and manipulate votes. The IP addresses into the Edison Research host service went in both directions, meaning that not only were China and Iran and other countries accessing the servers, but also Edison Research was communicating back to these adversaries. The claims that Dominion voting machines were not connected to the internet are completely false. Cybersecurity experts have followed the communication of the data from Dominion voting servers and Edison Research to foreign countries. A simple web search will uncover that DominionVotingSystems.com is registered to a company in Hunan, China. Three of the seven board members of UBS Securities are Chinese nationals. That company owns Staple Street Capital, which in turn owns Dominion. On top of that, the Dominion software is licensed from Smartmatic, which is a Venezuelan-owned and controlled company, and we're all familiar with how their elections go. Furthermore, forensic audits of the machines reveal significant errors. Although the mainstream media and politicians are saying that it's dangerous misinformation that Dominion voting systems are unsecure, this was the very message that several left-leaning news sources were claiming less than a year ago. NBC News and PBS found out just how easy it is to hack voting machines or cast fake votes.
It's important to know that Georgia just spent over $100 million on a contract with Dominion to provide image cast hardware to the state in time for the next primaries and for the 2020 election. And yet here these kids were who had opened it up. They said, look, you can pop the front off of it and here's a port you can get into right here. That's easy. You know, all kinds of stuff that you could certainly do within 6 minutes behind a curtain, much less if you had extra time because any of these were connected to the web, as we discovered a couple of days before so many of them are.
Despite opposition and attacks, election security experts were able to audit Dominion voting machines in Antrim County, Michigan, revealing unusually high error and adjudication rates. What does that mean? According to the report, Dominion voting systems is intentionally designed with inherent errors to create systemic fraud and influence election results. Ballot errors are sent to adjudication, which means the vote can be decided by an election worker where there is no oversight, no transparency, and no audit trail.
It's interesting to note that Michigan, where they did that audit in Antrim County, they say that they have this high error rate, which then go to these adjudications files where the votes can be manipulated. In violation of Michigan law, apparently all of the adjudication files for the 2020 election have disappeared. Now let's listen to some audio from one of Rudy Giuliani's recent Common Sense podcasts. That's his program, Common Sense, Rudy Giuliani's Common Sense, in which he talks about communist China's stated goal of what he calls supplanting the USA by 2049, which, by the way, would be the 100th anniversary of the communist Chinese party's takeover of mainland China. Play soundbite three, please.
We all kind of think back to the Nixon, Kissinger going to China and opening China. You know, Nixon goes to China is an expression of somebody doing something opposite their political philosophy. Nixon had always been a very, very strong anti-communist, and therefore he had the credibility to be the one that could go to China. If some more liberal or left-wing politician had done it, it probably would have been a very, very difficult thing for him to get away with. But Nixon did do that. And over a course of several years, and then continued quite effectively by Carter and then Reagan, the relationship seemed to be developing into a into a, if not a good one, a useful one. It became a deep relationship. The governments got to know each other. The businesses got to know each other. People got to know each other better. And it was a very useful tool, very useful leverage, very useful dynamic in ending the Cold War, because it created a leverage against Russia because of the ancient animosity and border disputes and everything else between China and Russia, and a sort of inherent distrust between the two countries. And it was played really well by Nixon, Carter, Reagan, maybe up to Bush, 41. And although it's not the main reason we prevailed in the Cold War, I'd say that had more to do with the actions taken by President Reagan, by what happened in Poland, by Thatcher and Pope John, and even Gorbachev. It certainly played a role, maybe somewhere. It certainly helped. And once the Cold War was over, it seemed like the relationship between the United States and China could be one of never complete friendship, because such a difference in the type of government we have and the values that we hold dear, but that it could be an effective, practical relationship with always some massive disagreements about human rights and civil rights. And on the American side, our always optimistic viewpoint that someday China become a democracy. I mean, how could it remain a dictatorship forever with half the population starving and half the population wealthy? That's a bit of an oversimplification, but pretty close to how it works out in day-to-day relationships. And that eventually those people held in bondage who were being brought into the middle class would demand a right to vote, a right of free speech. And we went along that way. In the 50 years, almost 50 years since the opening. Remember, next year will be, I believe, the 50th anniversary of Nixon goes to China. So it's a long relationship. And the thing that really created a way in which we could look at China and kind of be in denial about what they were really all about internally was when the Clinton administration deliberately decoupled human rights and the rest of the relationship with China, the political, the business, the economic, the trade, so that, yes, we would concentrate on human rights, but not the way Carter did, for example, and to some extent Reagan and Bush. We would still do a review of human rights. We'd make note of the things that we thought were doing wrong, but it would never involve any sanctions or very, very strong action taken anywhere. We lost sight of the fact that there was this reality to China. There was also the notion back in the 90s, I'd say, maybe a little earlier, goes a little later, and books about the peaceful rise of China. There was the notion, which is either true or presented as part of Chinese propaganda, which is enormously effective, by the way, that there were two types of people in China, two schools of thought in the Chinese Communist Party. One were the militants, the ones who wanted a strong army, a strong navy, and they wanted to come and take over the United States' position as the leading country in the world. And the other was the people who were content with the peaceful rise of China. They even called it that. That China would become a true economic competitor to the United States because they claimed that China had no territorial ambitions. Which, of course, if you take just a slight look at history, isn't true. China's always had territorial ambitions. In fact, it's been the reason for most of its wars. But in any event, that peaceful rise scenario, you know, two Chinas, like we used to call ourselves, the doves and the hawks, the peaceful ones, the warlike ones, and our eternal optimists telling us that if we did business with them, the more we did business with them, the more we exposed ourselves to them, the more the doves would rise and the hawks would recede. And behind that happy face, they forged not just close relationships with our government, but they forged very, very close relationships with our businesses, making those relationships enormously lucrative for American businesses so that the Chinese market became the desirable market, the one which you would maybe sell your soul. So the Chinese happy face worked for a long time. I mean, this notion that we were helping to bring along the forces of democracy in China. And then along comes Xi Jinping. And from the very beginning, Xi Jinping displayed an attitude much more nationalistic, much more aggressive, seemed to lean much more toward the rise of China, not necessarily with the word peaceful modifying it. Some of our really best China experts, and I would have to view them as the ones we should rely on now, way back in the beginning of the 21st century, wrote books noting this and warning us about it. It was in 2017, was the Party Congress, and Xi Jinping stood up and made it clear, in no uncertain terms, he made it clear that by 2049, China would realize its full blossoming, and it would be the leading economy and the leading power in the world. Of course, the other power, the only other power, was the United States. So what he's saying very simply is, my goal and why I'm doing these things, why we're doing business all over the world, why we're increasing our military, why we're moving into those islands, why we're challenging you in various parts of the world and creating problems for you in Iran and every place else we can, is because our goal is to supplant you. We believe it is our destiny as Chinese to rule the world. Now, is that just a, well, so we are or they are a situation? Or can you see a major difference between the two? Because if you can't, I'm not sure you really understand or love America. What a difference, huh? How about replacing that with a regime that is run by a Communist Party apparatus that is a country of 1.4, 1.5 billion ruled by 90 million people who are oligarchs? The Chinese communists, I mean, communism is a strange description. The people at the top of the party are as rich as the people as the oligarchs in Russia, and maybe even more corrupt. So when you think of the Chinese Communist Party, that's who we're talking about with China. The rest don't matter. They're told what to do. They're put in prison in the millions. They're killed. They're killed. You know, they were killed for a while if they had the girl babies were killed. Say it still happens in China. Abortions of female babies happen all over the provinces of China. They just don't like females very much. That's really an economic issue. Everything's an economic issue. You have them with their amoral, immoral, homicidal attributes ruling the world. I mean, that's a world you don't want to live in. So this is not a six of one and a half dozen of the other thing. And please, please, how many times have we made this mistake? Hitler told us what he was going to do. Stalin told us what he was going to do. Bin Laden told us what he was going to do, and we ignored it. We ignored it, and we got the Second World War. We ignored it, and we got the Cold War, Korea, Vietnam. We ignored Bin Laden. We got the worst attack, domestic attack in the history of this country by a foreign source. It's going to be the 20th anniversary of that this year. Is it now about time that we take these people seriously?
I'm assuming that supplanting the U.S. means taking us over, possibly even militarily. At least that's the impression I get from Giuliani's comments. There are always going to be other world powers, and I'm certainly not calling for the USA to be the dominant world power. Who really wants us to be dominating the rest of the world, although other countries in the world say that we do that? But we do want to be powerful enough that we can't be taken over and subjugated, enslaved, and erased as a civilization. Now let's listen to some evidence and opinion about tricks and other activities of our political enemies, that is, the leftists and the globalists, who want to further communist China's plans for America. To start, here's President Trump's former trade advisor, Dr. Peter Navarro, on Fox's Sunday Morning Futures program recently with Maria Bartiromo, talking about how the now exposed deep state mole and operative, former Attorney General Bill Barr, worked against Trump and aided Joe Biden. It begins with Bartiromo commenting on a soundbite with Senator Marco Rubio of Florida on Biden's blitz of executive orders from the time he was sworn in. Play soundbite four, please.
That was Florida Senator Marco Rubio raising the red flag on President Biden's signing blitz when he joined me last week on Fox News Primetime. Before an executive order reaches the president's desk, it must first be vetted. It's vetted by the Department of Justice, which begs the question, how are 17 of these executive orders ready to go and waiting for President Biden to sign minutes after inauguration, on day one? Former White House trade advisor Peter Navarro prepared executive orders for President Trump. He knows the process better than most. Peter, good morning to you. Good to see you. So let's talk about that in terms of the executive orders. What is the process, Peter? Take us through so that we can better understand how it was that President Biden was able to get so many EOs out on day one.
Sure, Maria. In my term, 4 years at the White House, I probably drafted over 50 of these orders. What you have to do is make sure you have the statutory authority to do what you're going to do, right? And the last checkbox that needs to be done is at the Department of Justice for what's called form and legality. Now, here's the news behind the news. Bill Barr, President Trump's attorney general, actually turns out to be also Joe Biden's first attorney general, because here was what was happening. We had over 30 executive orders queued after Election Day, ready to go, but we kept running into all these roadblocks and hurdles. It turns out that Bill Barr's Office of Legal Counsel was fast-tracking all of these Biden EOs, and basically it was a deep state coup. Now, this has implications, Maria. I'll tell you about one that got away from us, and I'll tell you about one that Biden did. The first one that Biden did is an abomination. We did a beautiful executive order. I worked with Bruce Walker and Dan Brulé over the Department of Energy and Mark Menzies to basically prevent the communist Chinese from selling bulk power equipment into our electricity grid. If we ever have a conflict with China, they're much more likely to pull down our electricity grid using cyber attacks than they are to, say, drop a bomb on us. Why? Because that's modern warfare Chinese style, right? So we had this beautiful order. One of the orders that Bill Barr helped Joe Biden do was to basically unwind that order. So bad news there. At the same time, I was trying to get through this really good order on offshoring, and we couldn't get that through.
And that's the one that you worked on so much, offshoring. We want to take a break and come back and talk about that, because I see what's happening here. Stay with us. We're talking with Peter Navarro, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. We're back with former White House trade advisor Peter Navarro. Peter, you were telling us about the executive orders that you drafted, and one that got away was on onshoring, because you say Bill Barr was working on the incoming administration's EOs as opposed to the outgoing administration's EOs.
Yeah, we got slow walked at the Department of Justice, and this is a problem I told Barr about numerous times, and he should have been fired months before he was. I mean, by the last year of this administration, he was really working against this administration in a lot of ways. And these executive orders, the bottleneck was at the Department of Justice on so many things we did. But you can see what President Biden is doing now. He's just unwinding things that are going to come back to haunt the American worker big time.
Let me ask you about the economy. We have a $1.9 trillion stimulus package coming to Americans now with an economy that seems to have slowed a bit in the month of January. Your assessment?
In May of 2020, I was in the Oval Office with the president. We wanted to get a $2 trillion package passed, much like the one But we lost 9 months now because Nancy Pelosi thought it would be better to stonewall that package and hope that President Trump lost on the economy. She got her wish, but she has killed thousands, hundreds of thousands of small businesses. That's the scarring Janet Yellen has been talking about in her speech. And 2021 is going to be a tough time because those small businesses are gone. They ain't coming back.
Well, we also are wondering about the policy regarding China. You worked so much on that. Hunter Biden got a $2 million advance for his new book. It is now on the bestseller list, Beautiful Thing, it's called, by Hunter Biden, and he still has that investment in a Chinese company. Does that get in the way of policy?
4 minutes after Joe Biden got inaugurated, I went on the sanctions list of China, along with Pompeo, Pottinger, Bannon, and others. And meanwhile, Hunter Biden, a crack addict who used influence peddling to profiteer in China with a top Chinese spy, using his father's name to make money, is getting a $2 million book deal. Well, Josh Hawley is getting his book contract burned. That's an abomination.
That's true. Wow. Peter Navarro, always a pleasure. Good to see you, sir. Have a good Sunday, and have a good Sunday, everyone.
Navarro, that's N-A-V-A-R-R-O, who holds a Ph.D. in economics from Harvard, has an excellent analysis of the 2020 election fraud issues on his website, peternavarro.com. Lastly, here's audio from a video podcast conservative commentator Dinesh D'Souza did recently, questioning whether House Speaker Nancy Pelosi knew more than she has let on about the origins and intent behind the Capitol riot in early January, while Electoral College votes were being counted, and which handed the presidency to Biden. You can find this video with many others by D'Souza on rumble.com. Play soundbite 5, please.
Is Nancy Pelosi keeping a deep, dark secret about her role in the events of January 6th? One of the strangest things about what happened that day was the simple sight of streams of people moseying into the Capitol with token, for in some cases, no resistance whatsoever. People are moving barriers. Policemen, when they're around, are stepping aside. This is extremely strange under normal circumstances. If you or I go to the White House or the Capitol, we can't get in. There's all kinds of people to block us. There's all kinds of security. There are metal detectors. So the unobstructed ease of access of all these people, of a crowd of people, to get into the Capitol is a mystery. Now, as we learn information about all this, we discover that Trump offered 10,000 National Guard troops to protect the Capitol. This offer was declined. We also find out that Steve Sund, the U.S. Capitol Police Chief, called for National Guard backup 2 days before January 6th. His offer was declined. And declined by whom? Declined by the Sergeant of Arms working in cohorts in consultation with Nancy Pelosi's office. It's kind of an odd fact, but apparently the Capitol Police are under the control of the Congress, in other words, of the Speaker of the House, not under the control of the White House or of Trump. So Nancy Pelosi is involved in this. And so she, in a sense, says no to added security. Muriel Bowser, the mayor of D.C., says no to added security. They're kind of emphatic on this point. Now, the Sergeant of Arms gives the only reason I've seen given at all for this strange behavior. It's strange because, let's remember, we know that there was a large crowd of people and kind of an angry crowd coming to D.C., Trump, during the impeachment proceedings, was faulted. You know, you should have foreseen that there was going to be trouble. Well, if Trump could have and should have foreseen it, certainly the same information was available to Nancy Pelosi. She could have and should have foreseen it. So they knew this was a lot of people come into town, and yet they declined security. Supposedly this was, according to the Sergeant of Arms, due to, quote, the optics. They didn't want to make it look weird by having all these guards present. Now, this explanation to me makes absolutely no sense. Because first of all, when there is a real threat, you need security. The optics don't really matter. And we know this because for Biden's inauguration after January 6th, they didn't worry about the optics. There was huge security all over D.C., massive walls, military troops, guns. So the left is not reluctant to make a show of force when they need to. There clearly is something else afoot. And of course, there's a dark possibility which suggests itself automatically almost. And that is, did Nancy Pelosi know and reasonably expect that there would be trouble? But she cunningly realized that if there was trouble, she could pin the blame of it on Trump. Now, this begins to make a lot more sense because we know the Democrats have a kind of operating principle, never let a crisis go to waste. And you can just add a corollary to that. What if you can actually foresee and perhaps even do your little part to foment the crisis? In other words, don't take the reasonable steps that would prevent the crisis from getting out of hand. Why? Because then you can exploit it politically. Now, right after January 6th, what does Nancy Pelosi do? She fires the Sergeant of Arms. She fires the Capitol Police Chief Sund. She replaces him with another guy. And very interestingly, the police union, the union that actually represents the Capitol Police, took a vote, and 92% of them have voted no confidence in this, quote, new leadership. In other words, in this guy, Yogananda Pittman, Nancy Pelosi's man, that she stuck in there. The Capitol Police are basically saying, we don't think this guy is any good. He's a continuation of the failed leadership that has characterized the Capitol Police in the past. Now, Nancy Pelosi accused Steve Sund, the Capitol Police chief, the guy she fired, of he hasn't called us since this happened. He hasn't briefed us. Well, Steve Sund points out that he briefed Pelosi twice on January 6th. So Nancy Pelosi is not being truthful about the events of January 6th. She wants a 9/11 style commission to look into Trump's responsibility. Hey, if we weren't successful in convicting him, let's see if we can get him through this 9/11 style commission. Well, her own role in this, I think, demands investigation. In fact, a group of Republican congressmen have written her a letter basically saying, hey, Nancy, you know, you have taken all these bizarre measures after January 6th. You're actually tightening security inside the Capitol. In other words, you've got all these magnetometers and so on that actually regulate the flow of congressmen going back and forth through the hallways, as if to say that you have, that the people you have to fear are Republican congressmen. And what the congressmen are saying is this is downright crazy. The real threat always comes from the outside, from somebody assaulting the Congress or assaulting the Capitol. So Nancy's behavior here is peculiar, to say the least. Does it have a nefarious motive? I'm not sure. But the given explanation, we're trying to manage the optics, is so ridiculous, so unbelievable, that we have to look for a more believable explanation.
It's been my contention for some time that the Democrats and their allies, the communists and the globalists, often conduct false flag operations to disrupt otherwise legitimate opposition activities and distract public attention from the issues being raised. The Capitol riot appears to be one of these. Although some true Trump supporters were suckered into engaging in illegal activity, and by the way, the great, great majority of people that went to the rally in Washington, D.C. on the 6th of January were completely peaceful. And Trump exhorted those going to the Capitol to be peaceful. But of course, the riot had begun even before Trump finished speaking, according to the timeline I've seen. The riot clearly involved Antifa and Black Lives Matter activists, was planned in advance, and had this desired effect of casting shame and blame on Trump and his supporters and diverting public attention away from election fraud allegations. As I said, we've certainly got our work cut out for us if we are going to turn this present awful situation around. Mike Lindell, producer of the election fraud documentary Absolute Proof, also available on Rumble.com and elsewhere, is about to come out with a follow-up to that documentary and has stated that all the talk of Republicans taking back the House and Senate in 2022 and the White House in 2024 is pure nonsense if we can't get our elections straightened out. Maria Zack, founder of Nations in Action and one of the leaders in investigating the 2020 elections, has stated she believes foreign and domestic interference in our elections in support of leftist Democrats and rhino Republicans has gone on for at least the past 20 years. Her organization's claim that Italy's former leftist government was involved in internet vote switching from Trump to Biden is documented on the organization's website. Actually, they set up a website about that, and it's called italy-did-it.com. It's high time we thoroughly investigated and exposed the widespread allegations of election fraud. If there's no fraud, as the establishment keeps insisting, why are they so determined to prevent investigations? The Constitution makes it clear that the state legislatures are responsible for determining how the states will operate elections. It's obvious to me that major changes will be required if we're going to avoid future elections like the 2020 elections. That's no easy task, as evidenced by the hard-bitten opposition still being put up against virtually all attempts by state governments in the key swing states to investigate, uncover, and correct election fraud. And of course, there has been no investigation by our badly compromised federal government institutions. I've read that many state legislatures have been bought off by lobbyists or are otherwise compromised and reluctant to expose the depth and breadth of election operations problems in their respective jurisdictions. As has been sadly noted, our judiciary has largely failed us in this respect, this regard, with many of the judges involved in election fraud cases being left-wing activists or having been compromised in one way or another. The most shocking example being the three Trump nominees to the Supreme Court, Barrett, Kavanaugh, and Gorsuch. They sided with leftists and anti-Trump justices to sidestep dealing with the powerful arguments made by Texas and the 17 or 18 states which joined it in challenging the results of the 2020 voting in the key swing states, which decided the presidential election. These states were declared not to have standing to challenge the 2020 election by 7 of the 9 Supreme Court justices, with Justices Thomas and Alito dissenting. Other court cases are continuing, but their outcomes remain in doubt. The Supreme Court is set to rule this week on a number of related election fraud cases. If the High Court refuses to consider these cases, it will confirm the worst fears of many in this country that even that formerly august institution is badly compromised and in league with the nation's worst enemies. Nevertheless, I still believe, along with millions of others, that we can fix our elections before the country is completely lost. But if the opposition controls the elections and our judiciary, then the country is lost. It will take a lot of effort and involvement on all our parts. Remember what Ben Franklin said right after the signing of the Declaration of Independence. "We had better all hang together," he said, "or we will surely all hang separately." That's it for another show. Look for us again 2 weeks from now in this same time slot. Thanks for tuning in, and good night.